Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Well, Tony Bruschi, thanks for joining us. We're going to go to the courtroom where a hearing for Karen Reed took place this week as prosecutors seek to ban a defense data expert and their work that they call forensically and scientifically unsound. Let's go to the courtroom right now for that hearing.
All persons have any business before the Honorable Beverly Cannoni, Justice of the Norfolk Superior Court, Unified County of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
Judge, this is 22-117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Can I have counsel identify themselves, starting with the Commonwealth?
Good morning, Your Honor. Laura McLaughlin for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Ms. McLaughlin.
I'm out for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Your Honor. Hank Brennan for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Brennan.
Good morning, Your Honor. Alan Jackson on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Alessi on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Alessi.
And good morning, Your Honor. David Giannetti for Karen Reed.
Good morning, Mr. Giannetti. Good morning, Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Oh. Good morning, Mr. Burchie. Okay, let's see. So we've got several matters for this morning that I want to discuss. So first, there's filed a motion to recover expert-related expenses from the Commonwealth, and we'll discuss that in some manner at the end of the hearing today. We've also got Mr. Birch is here on Ms. Voss's opposition to the notes. And then there's the Commonwealth's motion for reciprocal discovery pertaining to the employees of ARCA. And the last one is the Commonwealth's motion to exclude witness Richard Green's debunked opinions. So those are really in that order, except I think we should start with the non-party Gretchen Voss's motion to reconsider regarding the notes. And I do want to say that I received this morning a motion to file an amicus memo. The signatory is Mr. Albano. I've received that. I will allow that to be filed. And I've read the motion and the memorandum. So I will hear you, Mr. Birchie.
Good morning, Your Honor. Rob Birchie for Gretchen Voss. I'd like to start by just thanking the court for taking the time and giving me the opportunity to revisit the court's ruling of December 5. That ruling allowed in full the Commonwealth's renewed motion for all audio recordings, interview notes, emails, text messages, and voicemails in the possession of Gretchen Voss or MetroCorp. Ms. Voss and MetroCorp complied with the court's order for production of documents on January 2nd. By producing to the court all of the responsive materials, the unredacted tapes, and the text messages that involved on-the-record communications by Voss with Defendant Reed. I'm here today to implore the court to reconsider that part of its ruling that also would require Gretchen Voss to turn over handwritten notes of an interview with Reed that the parties had agreed in advance would be off the record. What's in those notes is really a black box. The Commonwealth has provided no information indicating what it believes the notes will reveal.
You are unmuted.
Particular reason to delve into them. So the question before the court is whether the Commonwealth should be entitled to forage through this reporter's notes and compel her to break her promise of confidentiality with the source in the ungrounded hope of finding relevant and material evidence somewhere in those notes that will aid in a prosecution of the defendant. The stakes for Gretchen Voss are considerable, as she set out in her second affidavit submitted to the court with our motion for reconsideration. Her effectiveness as an investigative reporter depends upon her having the ability to use the tools of the journalism trade, and among them is the opportunity to reliably assure her sources that certain information they provide to the reporter will be off the record. The precedential stakes are high as well, because the Commonwealth is essentially asking the court to give no weight whatsoever to the off the record notion nature of the notes. And that is what renders a journalist's promise of confidentiality illusory. Off the record is a phrase you hear in virtually every conversation between a reporter and a source. Frequently it's an interjection in the course of a sentence. You know, this is off the record. The kind of lubricant that allows a source to have a free and full exchange with the reporter without having to guard every word they speak. And receiving information off the record is often a technique by a reporter to establish trust and rapport with a source. That source might be a whistleblower, might be a frightened migrant, or might, like Reed, be a criminal suspect. On page 2 of our motion for reconsideration, we quote from a primer on journalism that says, off-the-record interviews, quote, are essential in building trust between journalists and their sources, allowing for candid discussions that can provide context or background without the risk of public disclosure. The result, it says, is to enhance the depth of the reporting and provide leads for other sources. In Ms. Voss's case, she states in her second affidavit, which we filed with motion for reconsideration, at paragraph 11, she says, obtaining information from sources off the record is a normal and critical part of my work. Like most investigative reporters, I frequently agree with sources, including named sources, to keep certain of their statements or interviews off the record, not to be published anywhere. Keeping my word on this is critical to maintaining credibility and trust, and thus maintain source relationships while not interfering with the flow of important information to the public. The court's December 5 order forces Gretchen Voss to choose between either keeping her word to her source and thereby violating the court's command, or else obeying the court's order and establishing herself as a reporter whose word cannot be trusted. It's an unnecessary choice to present to her, at least on the facts of this case. The court shouldn't insist on publication of the off-the-record notes because the Commonwealth has failed to meet its burden under Rule 17 to show that mandated production of the records on the facts of this case would not be unreasonable or oppressive. And also because requiring Voss to turn over these confidential notes would damage First Amendment interests more than it would benefit the public in achieving justice for this criminal defendant. Now, I keep saying on these facts, because it's very clear that the inquiry is a fact-sensitive one. The First Circuit wrote the Bruno and Stillman case that under Massachusetts law, the task is one that demands sensitivity, invites flexibility, and defies formula. While obviously the discretion of the trial judge has wide scope, it is a discretion informed by an awareness of First Amendment values and the precedential effect which decision in any one case would be likely to have. And in In re Cusumano in 1998, the First Circuit said, oh, that was a case like this one that involved a demand for confidential information from an identified source. The same court reinforced the fact-specific nature of the inquiry. In Cusumano, they said, when a subpoena seeks divulgement of confidential information compiled by a journalist in anticipation of publication, courts must apply a balancing test. This test contemplates consideration of a myriad of factors, often uniquely drawn out to the factual circumstances of the particular case. Now, as I noted in the December 5 order, the court drew no distinction between the on-the-record and off-the-record interviews. When it applied the Massachusetts balancing test for mandating production of reporters' notes, texts, and audio texts, audio recordings, it did not treat this confidentiality promise as a factor in the equation. That, we submitted, was critical oversight. Because whether you call it a privilege or not under Massachusetts law, Massachusetts does recognize that there is some degree of deference to be given to a promise of confidentiality. In Bruno and Stillman, the court said, courts faced with enforcing requests for the discovery of materials, notice as materials, not source identities, used in the preparation of journalistic reports should be aware of the possibility that the unlimited or unthinking allowance of such requests would impinge upon First Amendment rights. In determining what, if any, limits should accordingly be placed upon the granting of such requests, courts must balance the potential harm to the free flow of information that might result against the asserted need for the requested information. So, what are the factors that the court should look at when conducting an analysis under Rule 17 and under the balancing test? Taking Rule 17 first, set out in the LaRouche case, they cite the Nixon case where the Supreme Court ruled that in order to require production prior to trial, the moving party has to show, number one, that the documents are evidentiary and relevant, number two, that they're not otherwise procurable reasonably in advance of trial by the exercise of due diligence. Number three, that the party cannot properly prepare for trial without such production and inspection in advance of trial, and that the failure to obtain such inspection may tend unreasonably to delay the trial. And number four, that the application is made in good faith and, critically, is not intended as a general fishing expedition. In short, the court was explaining that the special prosecutor in Nixon was required to clear three hurdles: relevancy, admissibility, and specificity. And the court held in Nixon that there was a sufficient likelihood that the tapes contained conversations relevant to the offenses charged, and sufficient preliminary showing that the subpoenaed tapes contained admissible evidence. In this case, however, there's been no showing that the handwritten notes contain information relevant to the offenses charged, and no showing that the handwritten notes contain admissible evidence. When you apply it to the facts of this case, there is uncertain relevancy of the information in the off-the-record notes. Not seeing them, it's hard to know whether they're relevant or not. But there's no specificity whatsoever in the form of a preliminary showing by the Commonwealth that the notes contained admissible evidence. Compare that to the materials the court ordered disclosed. The court found that there were indications in the redacted audio tapes that when unredacted, the tapes would contain relevant and admissible evidence. That's on page 5 of the court's order, which says the Rule 17 standard is satisfied, not only based on the tapes. But there's no examination whatsoever of whether the interview notes would be anything more than a fishing expedition. To the contrary, the fact that nothing from that interview that resulted in the handwritten notes, nothing from that interview was used in the story, and that would suggest that the interview did not contain significant relevant information. As to the balancing test and the First Amendment interests, here too, the December 5 order ignores the on-the-record, off-the-record distinction. That distinction matters. Confidential information is extra protection because, as stated in LaRouche, disclosure of such confidential material would clearly jeopardize the ability of journalists and the media to gather information, and therefore would have a chilling effect on speech. The in LaRouche identified First Amendment interests that militate against disclosure of confidential information. One was the threat of judicial intrusion into the news gathering process. Another was the disadvantage of a journalist appearing to be a research tool for the government. Number three was the resulting disincentive to keep outtakes, or in our case, keep notes. And number four, the burden on journalists' time and records and resources in responding to subpoenas. And if you look, Your Honor, at the affidavit of Chris Vogel that was submitted with our original opposition, he talks about each of those factors in his affidavit from paragraphs 13 through 18. He says he worries that compelled disclosure may lead to a public perception that Mrs. Voss is taking sides in this case or is acting as an investigative arm for the judiciary. Trust in the news media is already fragile because reporters compile information for a living. They will always, always be attractive targets of discovery for one side or the other. The unrestrained use of subpoenas to compel testimony or documents from reporters will create or reinforce the impression that objective journalists are working as agents of the government or the defense. The Fourth Estate can only serve its role as a pillar of democracy if it has the public's trust. Second concern that editor Chris Vogel pointed out in his affidavit was that another risk of compelled disclosure is that it becomes easy, if it becomes easy or routine to subpoena journalists to hand over their interview notes, the legal and administrative costs of baffling or complying will chip away at the precarious resources of much of the media. A third factor that was concerning him was that easy allowance of media subpoenas also risks leading to a decline in investigative journalism altogether. This is the most expensive kind of journalism. Reporting, writing, editing, and fact-checking investigative pieces takes significant time and resources. Magazines like Boston Magazine will not be able to risk becoming enmeshed in situations such as this one, with the result that they shy away from controversial topics and the flow of vigorous reporting will suffer. We'll feel we have no choice but to select tamer, less controversial topics for our coverage. Another concern expressed by editor Vogel is that reporters will be incentivized to destroy notes and interview tapes after a story is published, and that could harm the news outlet that it later needs to follow up on that piece. A fifth consequence is that reporters may tend to be circumspect in the way they gather information, in the way they conduct their interviews, and not be so vigorous in their questioning of sources and their documenting of interview notes, aware as they will be that their work may become the subject of public and judicial oversight. And finally, one factor that separates this case from many other cases out there is that Gretchen Voss has been the subject of invasive vitriol simply for writing back this controversial and very public matter. Public disclosure of her interview notes in this case risks putting her again in the limelight and triggering a new round of harassment. Now, the court mentioned in its ruling that it appeared that she was no longer in fear of harassment because she had attended every day of the trial. I would submit that that shows that she was dedicated to covering the trial, come what may. She tells me she has, in the recent past, gotten more pushback on social media, including the fact that one commenter on Facebook, who I won't name, posted her personal telephone number for everyone, and the commenter to that post suggested I'll call her right away. And she's received several strange phone calls since that time. Because of the disproportionate harm to First Amendment and Article 16 interests caused by production of the confidential interview notes. We ask this court to reconsider its December 5 ruling and deny that part of the Commonwealth's motion that seeks those notes.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I do have one point to make to you, Mr. Birch. In the amicus brief, or the memo that was filed this morning, I just want to be clear that I am not looking for Ms. Voss's own interpretations as well as her likely impressions and thoughts about the interview and overall story to be provided. But it makes sense to me, and I'm going to hear from the Commonwealth, and if you want to respond first, that any information that reflects or relates to conversations with the defendant must be turned over.
I'm not sure what the question is.
So I'm not looking. The amicus brief and your argument suggests that if I order these notes to be provided, and just to be clear, I do appreciate that they were provided to me to review in camera. So I can see a distinction between what I'm being told that generally all notes reflect the author's interpretations as well as her likely impressions and thoughts about the interview and overall story. That's not what I'm considering releasing. But I think in this criminal case, the Commonwealth has proven that any material that reflects or relates to communication with the defendant must be turned over. So what I'm going to propose is that I do believe that there's some material in these notes that I don't need to provide to the Commonwealth, that I don't need to order be provided to the Commonwealth, that are just sort of observations. It's the communication between the defendant that's critical here. So I'm going to give you the opportunity to propose redactions to me. I have the notes, and you can propose redactions to things that are not reflective of communication with the defendant, observations, things of that nature.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the interview notes that is reflected in the story except architectural details, that there's a rosary on the bureau, or the wall is blue, or whatever it might be. And I went through the notes with this question in mind. Can you separate the impressions, integrity of the thoughts of the writer from the statements of the interviewee? And I don't think they're distinguishable. I think they're
okay.
All melded together in one. And frankly, it's her selection of questions that she asks Ms. Reed that gives an eye-hole into what her thoughts are about the case. She shouldn't have to produce that work product. And the Commonwealth hasn't shown that there's any more relevancy to these conversations with Gretchen Voss than there would be with any other conversation that Ms. Reed had with anyone else. There's no reason for the Commonwealth to be going after Gretchen Voss as a reporter for this, other than the fact that she's a reporter and she's done the investigative work already that presumably the Commonwealth has already done.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commonwealth.
Your Honor, I'll simply say we defer to the court's judgment and whatever limitations the court imposes. I have no further argument.
Okay. All right. So I'll take this under advisement. Thank you. All right. So paper 442. This is the Commonwealth's motion for reciprocal discovery pertaining to employees of ACCA. And I know from when we were last in court, the Commonwealth was perhaps having conversations with the federal people to see if you could get anywhere with this. Is there anything I need to know in that regard? And if we need to do it at sidebar, we can do it at sidebar.
I don't think there's a need, Your Honor.
Okay.
Although it's not incumbent on the Commonwealth to pursue Rule 14 discovery of a party that's going to proffer an expert, Commonwealth made best efforts anyways. I filed a TUI letter, and I was unexpectedly not disappointed when I received a response last night. It's insufficient, it's inadequate, so the issue of pursuing Rule 14 discovery through the proponent of the expert, that being the defense in this case, is something that is a matter we're going to have to address.
Okay.
I did speak to the defense this morning. Since the TUI letter came last night, they have, I don't want to speak for them, but have asked if we would consider some time so they can respond. I am content if it gets deferred until the next date, but it is an argument that needs to be made.
Okay, who's arguing now for the defendant?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
I agree with Mr. Brennan's recitation of our conversation this morning. If it pleases the court, we did get that TUI letter. I was copied in on that letter late last night, reviewed it last night. I think that it'll be incumbent for me to at least analyze that letter in a little bit more detail and utilize that letter in my response to the Rule 14 argument. So if we can have another date.
Sure. Well, we have next week, Thursday and Friday scheduled. We'll do this next week and come up with proposals on how we can certainly not violate anything that the federal court has said we can't do, but ways that we can go about it.
We'll be mindful.
All right. So if you can work on that, I'd appreciate that.
Sure.
So I will take the lead from the two of you on that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So this brings us to the Commonwealth's motion to exclude defense witness Richard Green's debunked opinions. So I have received a great deal of pleadings on this. So the Commonwealth's motion, and there was a affidavit attached, a report attached from Mr. Whiffen. The defense has filed an opposition, an affidavit from Mr. Green, and then another affidavit from Mr. Green that doesn't, they're two separate affidavits. And the affidavits are clearly different in substance, so I'm a little, I don't know what you want me to think about that, but why don't we hear the Commonwealth on its motion first?
May it please the court, we filed a motion to exclude Mr. Green as a witness regarding two points. The first is a claim that a witness's phone made a search for a phrase to the effect of how long to die in a cold at 2:27 a.m. And secondly, to exclude an opinion that there was some type of intentional deletion of that entry. This case, I propose on behalf of the Commonwealth, is appropriate for a Lanigan hearing. At that Lanigan hearing, I suggest that Mr. Green should testify and answer questions about his affidavit and his opinions that he would like to subject the jury to. In fairness, the government would call an expert as well. If this case, as the court proposed, potentially is scheduled for next week, Mr. Whiffen would not be available, but Ms. Hyde would be available, and I would call her as a witness. Mr. Whiffen, if necessary, is available later in the month as a witness. My suggestion is there should be two witnesses, Mr. Green and one witness from the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth witness will be able to explain the science, the data, forensic science, and methodology. And Mr. Green, I suspect, should be in a position to explain his ultimate opinions because what we see in his affidavit is an absence of methodology. Mr. Green has filed two affidavits in this case. They are very similar, but there are very significant changes to those affidavits. And it stands out as very interesting, the changes to the affidavits, when I look at them. On number three, he changes his characterization of what his profession is. He originally calls himself a forensic technician, and then the updated affidavit cites that he's a computer network technician. Now that is odd, because usually a professional knows what they do for a profession. Recharacterizing the simple explanation of what he does stands out. Also stands out when using technical terms. They either were wrong or changed from the first affidavit to the second affidavit. For example, number nine, he talks about the download as a full file system extraction, then changed to an Apple iOS full file system. My point is that when you look, this isn't simply misspellings or poor grammar. There are terms of art that are wrong between the affidavits or changed. When you're using the terminology of an item that is a forensic tool, such as gray key, it is spelled wrong throughout the affidavit. And so it seems to me that Mr. Green's affidavit had some assistance in building it. And the tone of the affidavit supports that thought. When we look at Mr. Green's affidavit, it is not that of a forensic examiner, it's that of an advocate for the defense. When we look at his affidavit, there is quite a bit of advocacy, and insinuations and surmise and conjecture and claims that have no factual basis, but there is little on methodology. In ways, it is a very dangerous affidavit to simply make assault of comments that a user did something, purposely deleted a very important phrase, how long to die in the cold, without any forensic data or evaluation or validation. Similarly, when we look at his affidavit, it is replete with accusations suggesting, but never proving, never providing fact, that there was some type of manipulation or tampering with evidence. Now, this is not the role of a forensic examiner unless there is proof, in fact, that happened. But when we look through his entire affidavit, we don't see any attachment of raw data, or we don't see an updated report. We don't see any viable information that in any way supports his speculative accusations. And so the defense, without having an opportunity to Mr. Green prior to trial, stand behind these statements under oath, would like him simply to come before the jury, make these salacious comments, and then leave it to the government to knock it down. And that might be a common approach, reviewing the transcripts of this case, but the Commonwealth does not intend to simply let evidence come in that's not qualified, that's not factually sound, and then go knock down glass houses. That is not the approach the government is going to take to this case. Mr. Green is going to testify. He should have a report that is factually based with methodology supporting these claims, these narratives that he's proposing. Considering testing in this case, there are certain tools that are used. The defense wants to propose that there's some type of race that Mr. Green looked at or used more tools than a Commonwealth expert. The tool is simply software. A good analogy is that of an x-ray. Anybody can take an x-ray, but it takes an expert then to interpret the x-ray, to interpret the data. In this case, Mr. Green in his affidavit proposes that because he used a number of tools, because he has a number of x-rays, that somehow there's significance to it. But what it lacks is a forensic analysis of that information. And it is clear in his affidavit that it lacks that. He cites two opinions. His first opinion is based on Sunbright processing and Axiom processing. I'm not going to go through all the little details that we dispute or go through a technical assault on each point, although that may come at some point. But the overall idea of this evidence is why this should be subject to a Lanigan hearing and why we are willing to call our own expert as well, so that the record is clear and the science and data is clear. Instead of doing validation or testing, relying on Cellbreak, what Mr. Green has done in section number 13 of his affidavit is stepped aside from methodology, and instead he cites that he called Cellbright technical service. Now, this is the forensic examiner who is supposed to go through the process, and yet He defers it to technical support of Selbright. Technical support of Selbright, he relies on to say that this artifact, where this search is stored, is appropriate. And he remains standing on that foundation as why somehow there's some validation that this search occurred at 227. But then when he learns that Selbright, after actually doing analysis and study and updates and engaging methodology and review, determined that the way that was assessed is unreliable and the program has been updated, which no longer shows the 227 search at 227, and I'll explain why for good reason, and I'm sure the court has heard this before. Mr. Green then denounces the very source that he relies on. And so on one hand, he's saying, I relied on technical assistance of Selbright, but then when they told me what I didn't like, I can ignore that part. He then defers to Axiom. Axiom, the government, the defense touts, is a separate source that reinforces the same point when clearly it doesn't. You can see in number 14 of Mr. Green's affidavit, he talks about the fact he uses these different programs because he wants to view data. And that gets back to the X-ray analogy. He is viewing data from many different programs that say the same thing, but he never goes on to analyze it. What is troublesome about his affidavit in section 14 is he attempts to use resource material to convince this court that rather than methodology, these summary statements are something that the court should rely on. And so what he does is he takes an excerpt, page 7 of his affidavit, number 14, and he says that he reviews the Axiom user manual describing the artifact as follows, that the artifact is in Safari suspended state tabs and then has a last interaction date time, and the date and time of the current tab state when it was last interacted with on the local device. And so he's taking a piece of the manual, they don't introduce the manual, and he tries to use that to buttress that this search happened at 227. What you're not offered is that in the Axiom notes, in their artifact reference guide for the description of Safari suspended state tabs, which he's referring to, and this is the death knell, really, for the analogy that the defense tries to make. The Safari suspended tabs contains the current state of each browser tab in Safari that is currently open on the local device. The date and time are only updated when the user interacts with that tab on the local device. Since these are local tab states, results from the artifact may contain an earlier date and time compared to the results in the Safari history artifact if iCloud Safari synchronization is enabled across multiple devices on one iCloud account. And so, by Axiom itself, it makes clear that an artifact in a tab can reflect a time that is much earlier than the actual search. And this has been presented to the court, and we've provided the trial transcripts of Ms. Hyde and Mr. Whiffen. When a tab is open, many tabs can be open, it is open at a particular time, and if that tab is reused, the original time will imprint. And so, certainly Mr. Green knows of the Commonwealth's argument. He knows of the opinions by Mr. Whiffen and Ms. Hyde, because he takes shots at them or makes mention of them in his report, and yet he does nothing as far as validation to consider the arguments and dispel them. He does nothing in his affidavit to address the methodology. Quite to the contrary, when you see Mr. Whiffen and Ms. Hyde's reports, it isn't baseless opinions and advocacy of a side. When you look at their reports, it is replete with methodology. Fact-based, information-based, the study of the particular device at hand. The contrast between the actual use of methodology that is reflected in Ms. Hyde and Mr. Whiffen's report in this affidavit is so clear. Now, there are two opinions that are proposed pursuant to this affidavit. The first is the claim that How Long to Die in the Cold was somehow inputted at 227. The only effort that appears in this affidavit by Mr. Green is in section 15, where he did a low-level analysis of the wall file. Now, I am not an expert, and that's why the court should hear from Ms. Hyde or Mr. Whiffen and Mr. Green. But a simple understanding of the data science is that the wall file can contain information as a repository. And the description or misunderstanding by Mr. Green of the wall file is clear in his affidavit. In fact, he implies that there were three searches in his affidavit, number 16, when almost everybody universally agrees who's looked at this phone that there were two. And so there's no surprise that his second opinion is an attempt, really, just to create confusion, to disparage, and to make claims that are factually untrue. It's necessary to have this claim because number one doesn't have any resonance. There's no methodology to support number one. So of course the fallback is somebody did something somewhere somehow. Not an uncommon refrain that we hear. And so what the claim or the opinion number two the defense would like the jury to hear is that somebody somehow, whether it was a person, presumably the witness in this case, or the police somehow manipulated the phone. I dare say there's no evidence to support that. And yet, in an affidavit under oath to the court, in an attempt of advocacy, this witness is comfortable and willing to promote a claim that has no factual basis. If a witness, an expert, is going to promote in an affidavit a claim with no factual basis, we should not trust, without vetting that witness, that their other claims have any merit or value. In opinion number two, this expert, so-called expert, takes the liberty to say that the McCabe cell phone could have been manipulated. Not that it was, not that I did a study, not that I have a fact. It could have been manipulated, then rehashed after manipulation with the PDF being modified. Wow. An extraordinary conspiracy in the world of forensic science to be able to accomplish all of those tasks. So if he has no basis in fact or methodology, no good faith basis to make this assertion, why is he? It is because the claims he makes in opinion number one are so scientifically and forensically unsound. This is a tactic to confuse the issue. And think about the import of this baseless claim by Mr. Green. It is suggesting that a witness with no other evidence whatsoever was involved in a conspiracy to murder somebody. That's the implication that he wants the jury to be confused by. Otherwise, there'd be no other reason to make the suggestion. That is an extraordinarily harsh claim when you don't have any facts to back it up. Now, how could one cause manipulation? There is a scientific ways that could be explained how manipulation could occur, but we don't see any of that in this affidavit because it didn't exist in this case, because there was no deletion or manipulation by the witness. There was no manipulation by the police who processed this phone. If there was, there would be some proof. This affidavit speaks volumes by the absence of fact in data and science. Mr. Green does nothing to try to demonstrate that there was user deletion on this phone or that there was manipulation by the police. When you look at the data in the phone, the question arises, why is there a 624 search and not a 623 search? The phone stores the last entry into the tab. It's not just science, it's common sense. Common sense that Mr. Green ignores. And so not being able to prove user manipulation because it didn't happen, he turns to police manipulation. And he says that there can be a problem where the hashes don't match, but the problem is the hashes do. They match. He complains that he did not receive the PDF when he received the download. And because there was a production at different times, he then sprints out into a different universe and suggests that somehow it must be because there's manipulation. And again, doesn't prove it. There's actually ways that a real forensic examiner can look at the PDF, the gray key file, and the phone and determine whether manipulation occurred. There's a program called XMP and another one called Magic. The Cromwell's expert witnesses went through that process. No manipulation. But Mr. Green doesn't even go through the process to disprove his own theories. If he used methodology, he could simply dispel his own claims. It's either he doesn't understand the forensic technology to do that, or he chooses not to do it so he can just posit hand grenades throughout the case and let them resonate wherever they fall. In an attempt to create some doubt or uncertainty or merit some conspiracy, he lists a number of what he calls anomalies, which are really not anomalies at all. I could go through each one of them. I could give a difference of opinion. I could show that Mr. Green's anomalies have no basis in fact, but suffice to say, I think this should be done by qualified experts, and that's why there should be a Lanigan hearing. There is such misunderstanding of forensic science in Mr. Green's claims and anomalies. If he's going to make these assertions before it goes before a jury, he should sit in the witness seat under oath, as the Commonwealth witnesses should as well, and he should justify, explain to the court why he did not engage in methodology and how he has come to these extraordinarily baseless, inaccurate, and prejudicial claims. The court has to look at Lanigan and whether or not a hearing is appropriate in this case. When we look at the different non-binding factors of Lanigan, we look at number one, whether it has been generally accepted in the scientific community. The software has been generally accepted in the scientific community. So hasn't the effort of a forensic examiner, the expertise. And the defense complains in their motion, the Commonwealth has not properly addressed the methodology of Mr. Green. Well, the reason why is Mr. Green does not provide any methodology. So this is the way to address the methodology. Number two, the opinions have been or can be subjected to testing. Well, we see Ms. Hyde and Mr. Whiffen's report directly contradict the assertions, the unsupported assertions of Mr. Green. There is no testing that his opinions have been subjected to. There is no review. There is no other alternative support for his opinions. They're just broad, baseless claims. Number three, has been subjected to peer review and publication. Certainly the science, the forensic science has, the software has, but the interpretation and Mr. Green's interpretations, it hasn't been subjected to anything. In fact, it changes. Has an unacceptably high known or potential rate of error. Well, if we see and read Ms. Hyde and Mr. Whiffen's report, it's not just a high level of error, it's gross error, it's total error. It's wrong. And is governed by recognized standards. Well, if you look at the history report that the defense filed as an attachment, it talks about a forensic examiner's obligations to verify, to test things that Mr. Green didn't do. Their own report that they offer in support undermines the idea that Mr. Green did anything to validate or support his opinion. And as we see from both Selbright, he does not follow the protocol. He does not follow Axiom or the guidance that they give him. He sidesteps both of them to give the opinion he wants to advocate for the defense. At every turn, the positions of Mr. Green are not only unsupported, they're unverified. And so what arises from this subterfuge is that Mr. Green is really just a vessel or an attempted vessel for the defense, third-party culprit defense. It is not lost on me. I'm not unmindful of the data on the phone being a search, how long Diane Cole, that occurred at the 6 a.m. in that morning coincides with first responders' testimony that the defendant herself was asking these very same questions around that time about Mr. O'Keefe and how long he could survive the cold. Under the extraordinary broadness of circumstances and the depth of the amount of witnesses and information in this case, it is hard to think that that just happened by happenstance, that there is a inquiry, something forming in the mind of the accused is then shared with the witness, Ms. McCabe, and in response, she makes the search, which is entirely supported by all the credible forensic evidence. If Mr. Green is going to be a witness in front of the jury, in light of the fact that he has no methodology and he's wrong on the science, in addition to the fact that he wants to now appear as advocate for the defense and accuse everybody and anybody without articulating who, just anybody other than the defense, he should have to stand behind those claims under oath. And so I'm asking for a landing and hearing. We are not shying from our burden. We're more than happy to bring in a witness so the court can contrast the two. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Lessing?
May it please the court, Mr. Green is eminently qualified to provide testimony in this case with regard to the subject matter that has been challenged by the prosecution in this case, and that is with regards to the search, how long to die in the cold, that occurred at 2:27:40 a.m. on January 29, 2022. Mr. Green, and I want to cover the baseline for this hearing first. Mr. Green testified at the first trial. He testified without objections as to his qualifications. He testified without objections to his methodology. Your Honor sat, obviously, and presided over that trial. Your Honor did not issue, after his testimony, any limiting or curative instructions with regard to either his qualifications or methodology, nor did the prosecution, after his testimony, stand up and ask for any such limitations or qualification. The baseline for his qualifications and methodology was established, again, without objection.
But they are being challenged now.
I was just waiting, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. They are being challenged now, but the reason I state that is because what Mr. Green has provided in response to this motion is even more detail than what happened in the first trial. In Mr. Brennan's argument, he did not make one argument about Mr. Green's qualifications. Zero. So I'm assuming, because there's nothing in their motion that even goes into why he might not be qualified. So to me, Your Honor, that's a tacit concession, if not expressed, that he's qualified. And of course, he has to be qualified in digital forensics because there are five other areas of digital forensics opinions and methodology that Mr. Green is testifying about that has not been challenged. So to me, it is rather odd right off the jump that there's no challenge to five other areas of data forensics, and there's just this challenge to one aspect of his whole testimony and opinions. I have provided Your Honor with two exhibits demonstrative in support of my oral argument. Exhibit one is entitled Digital Forensics Methodology Regarding Subject Artifact, and Exhibit two is entitled Digital Forensic Product Tools Used by Witnesses. The Commonwealth has agreed to my use of those exhibits. They had some, I agreed to theirs. And I would like to, Your Honor, use those in a moment. The Commonwealth, in its oral argument, said 10 times just now that there's no methodology and that Mr. Green does not articulate a methodology. That is incredible to me because the opposition and Mr. Green's affidavit, in fact, are replete with the methodology. And here is the key, Your Honor. While Mr. Brennan challenges the methodology, none of his witnesses, neither Mr. Whiffen nor Ms. Hyde, challenge the methodology. As a matter of fact, in their two reports, neither of them even describe Mr. Green's methodology, nor do they challenge it. And of course they can't, because it's the same exact methodology that they use. And that's what I would like to go to now. Exhibit one is entitled Digital Forensics Methodology Regarding Subject Artifact, J. McCabe iPhone Data. And I prepared this. This is just what's in our opposition. It's in Mr. Green's affidavit, but it summarizes what the methodology is that we're talking about here. What is that methodology? Step one, you receive, and this is to answer the question about what is the proper interpretation of the artifact in question that everybody agrees is the artifact. Step one, receive a full file system image of extracted data from the Commonwealth. For example, the defense received it on a USB thumb drive. That's undisputed. If you look at the reports of Ms. Hyde, you look at the reports of Mr. Whiffen, they all say they received a full file system image of extracted data. So step one in the methodology that everybody agrees to, everybody agrees that occurred. Number two, verify hash signature value of image file of data received. This is very important because hash values with regard to forensic data is extraordinarily important for it to be proper because it's the signature, the fingerprint, that allows data forensic examiners to be sure that the data that they're giving is sacrosanct. It is not possible for manipulation. The Commonwealth just said that Mr. Green has hurled several accusations without a basis, one of which regards the potential for manipulation of data. And it's remarkable that there is even an issue about this dispute. Mr. Green did put in his affidavit an unprecedented situation, and it is this. Mr. Guarino, Trooper Guarino, in his April 2023 report, which is an exhibit to our opposition, states that when he got the phone of Ms. McCabe, he used Cellebrite UFED, a tool of Cellebrite, to image the phone. And that's all he sent to the defense in the beginning. Why is that unusual? Because what happens in every case, without exception, is that the law enforcement sends the raw image, original data that has the hash signature on it. And the hash signature is an algorithm that produces, they call it in this case SHA-256. What it is it's a stamp of reliability that says, as soon as we got this data.
That's the latest from the Karen Reed hearing as prosecutors seek to ban a defense data expert. We'll keep you up to date on the rulings as they come down right here. I'm Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our updates right here.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Military veterans and active duty service members, you could become a certified cyber warrior with just 12 weeks of training at My Computer Career. Cybersecurity specialists are in high demand, and IT pros with these skills often enjoy abundant opportunity and a great lifestyle. Protect our people, liberty, and treasured institutions from cyber threats. SkillBridge and other VA benefits are available to those who qualify. Learn more at mycomputercareer.edu/CWP. That's mycomputercareer.edu/CWP.